What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
I'm Carl Quintanilla. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in. Good Monday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Ford and Deirdre Bosa. Today, May Day M&A for tech as the Nasdaq tries to break its longest losing streak since the dot-com bubble in 01. With so many falling valuations, who is the next potential takeover target? VMware, according to some reports this morning, we're going to break down the latest as shares surge on news of this potential deal with Broadcom. That's not all. Got more on EA's takeover dreams, FTX's shift into stocks, and a whole lot more. Stocks and targets this hour, Dee.
Yeah, Kyle, we're going to start with that potential shakeup in the semi and software world. Sources telling CNBC that Broadcom is in talks to acquire cloud service provider VMware. Discussions are reportedly ongoing. No announcement is imminent, but it does paint an interesting picture of the M&A environment at this moment in 2022. After a record $5.9 trillion worth of deals last year, sinking valuations could mean some bargain basket prices for companies that have the cash or stock to do so. The value of M&A deals in the first quarter fell by more than 20% from the fourth quarter, according to Global Data. We will talk more about EA in a moment, which has been shopping itself around for a deal. John, it's interesting. The moment that we're in, price is still an issue here. What is the value of VMware? Its current market cap today is around just less than $50 billion. It was at $70 billion last October. It was even more than that in 2019. So obviously, everything looks a lot cheaper at this moment, but what Michael Dell in particular, who's still a major shareholder in VMware, that's going to determine whether this deal gets done or not. It's still a big question. What is it worth?
Well, yeah, I don't know exactly what it's worth. What is it worth to whom, I guess, is part of the question. But step back, why would Broadcom want to do this? I mean, here's a company with around, what, $27.5 billion net revenue. VMware's got around $13 billion in revenue. And when you look at Broadcom's operating income, about $11 billion in operating income from semiconductors, $5 billion from software. We don't always think about software when we think about Broadcom, but it's there. And then VMware would add about another $2.5 billion in software-related operating income if they were to combine. Then you would end up with a Broadcom that you're not necessarily thinking of as just a chip company anymore across those multiple arenas where they compete. It's pretty balanced chips and software in a sort of cloud and multi-cloud era where they would have more heft, not just with the hyperscalers, Carl. And I think it's that type of radical transformation of a model that we'd have to think about here.
Yep. A lot of people asking about strategic rationale this morning, John. One is it, as you say, sort of a continued migration from chips to software? Is it because VMware is cheap relative to peers? Or is it a sign of a Hock-Tan's worry about a slowing environment just days after Cisco talked about potentially that?
Well, let's get some perspective. Joining us now, GGV's Glenn Solomon. Glenn, this would be a even more dramatic than we've seen in the past transformation of what Broadcom is with a leg up for software in a multi-cloud era. Does this make sense? And I mean, the bias is always to make a case for why these things make sense. But what's the risk?
Well, look, John, I think, Broadcom's been on this trend for now a couple of 5+ years buying software and getting into the software business. I think they also see that VMware, although not born a cloud company, has moved hard to the cloud. And that's obviously where the puck is going. That's where they want to go. I mean, the risks to their business are anytime you do a large acquisition like this, integrations can be really difficult. And VMware is a company that's been around a while. You said earlier that this company has $5 billion already in software, so they'd have to merge it into an existing business. That's a risk. You know, integration is difficult.
Well, you also sort of have to have somebody running software, I imagine, and then somebody dealing with this really weird environment where the hyperscalers, AWS, Azure, Google, and then some others, they have a lot of power over what the components are in their clouds. They're competing with you, and you need to work with them, and you got to deal with enterprises that are trying to transform. How's Broadcom going to do it at that? Do they have the services and sales motion to take advantage of that if they were to combine here?
Well, I think it remains to be seen how much independence they'd leave for VMware. But VMware itself has been doing a very good job transitioning itself to the cloud, serving their Global 2000 and the hyperscalers very well. And their business is strong. So I think as long as they leave it alone, they're going to be in pretty good shape. But longer term, you know, as you point out, the software business is it's a free-for-all. There's players coming in from every angle. They want to be in this space. So I think it will remain competitive. And for this deal to work, VMware needs to continue to innovate.
Yeah, Glenn, that's exactly it, right? Players from all different areas wanting to come into this space. I'm reminded of when Intel acquired McAfee, right? And they said that, okay, maybe there was something there that was going to follow through for their chips, and that never really panned out. Is there something about Hock Tan, the CEO of Broadcom, that makes him more likely to succeed at doing something like this because he is such a deal maker and he's done it before?
You know, I think one thing underlying this deal that I think is very, very smart for Broadcom is, you know, they were unfortunately unable to get the Qualcomm deal done. And I think the administration at that time said, hey, we don't want a company that, you know, has too much of its roots in Asia acquiring a U.S. jewel. And so I think that was a wake up call for them. They've now acquired several businesses that are endemically U.S. And Western-focused tech businesses. I think this is part of the rationale for this deal.
Yeah, okay, so talk about the regulatory side of this then. VMware is a better-known name than some of the other ones that they have tried to, or they have actually acquired. It does have an important place among cloud companies. So what do you think is the likelihood of this deal being done if it is going to move forward?
You know, I think it's a brilliant move on their part because they're a hardware business. So difficult for regulators to say, hey, this is somehow going to lead to unfair practices. I don't know what gymnastics the regulators would need to do to block this deal, but it seems to make a lot of sense to me.
I do wonder overall, do you think it is is there an underlying comment about corporate demand for networking right now in this deal?
Corporate networking in the hardware sense, or
yes.
You're saying the way that...
Hardware, any kind of a degradation in the IT enterprise spending space going forward.
Okay, fair enough. Look, I think we're in shopping season for acquisitions in software, and certainly companies that have presence and market share in the cloud. You know, this is one of many deals that we've seen, and if there's hundreds of billions of dollars on the sidelines in private equity funds. And in large tech companies that have a lot of cash. And so I really don't think this is a one-off. I think that we'll see more deals like this. Investors in the public market just sort of move from valuing growth more highly to growth and profitability more highly. So I think VMware is the type of company you'll see on people's shopping lists where, you know, maybe growth isn't quite what it once was, but profitability is part of the picture.
Glenn, why isn't VMware the one acquiring stuff? I mean, I'm thinking back, VMware's vision from early on has been largely correct. You know, we're in this multi-cloud era. We need translation between different types of environments. This is supposed to, VMware was supposed to be skating to where the puck was going all along. So why is it getting acquired by this company, that company? It's with Dell, EMC. Now it's getting snapped up by Broadcom. Why haven't they bulked up and why aren't they leading this era?
Yeah, it's like dolphins acquiring minnows, but now whales acquiring dolphins. It's a good question, John. And, you know, I think I'm sure that the private equity money that's in VMware today didn't come into it thinking it was going to be a flip. They were looking for, you know, an acquisition and kind of roll up strategy. And VMware has made a lot of acquisitions over the years. Nothing this big, obviously. And I think that this is really a story about who's trying to bulk up, who can get bigger faster. And so, again, I don't think you'll see this as a one-off. I think you'll see more acquisitions, and some will be really large.
All right. Glenn, thank you. Glenn Solomon. Thanks, Sean.
Let's broaden it out a bit, talk more about software investing writ large. Joining us this morning, Calixto Global Investors founder and portfolio manager Eduardo Costa. Eduardo, it's great to have you back. I don't know if you want to address Broadcom specifically, but I know you're focusing on companies facing difficult comps, decelerating growth, and are still in some instances dealing with elevated multiples, or at least multiples that you think the market sees as too high.
Hey, Carl, thanks so much for having me on. Great to be here. It's a fascinating time because there's a lot of opportunities on both the long and the short side. As it relates specifically to your question on companies facing difficult comps, there's a number of sectors right now, including the fintech and payments space, where there's been an explosion of consumer credit proliferation over the course of the 2 years of the pandemic, with a lot of companies emerging. But, you know, the buy now, pay later companies like an Affirm and a Klarna, as well as some of the newer companies that have emerged like an Upstart or a SoFi. And so there are going to be winners and losers in that space. But we're seeing inflation is really hitting the low end consumer, and that's causing defaults and delinquencies to start to rise. And so I think that some companies in that space are going to have challenges. Similarly, you're seeing across e-commerce, inflation is really starting to take a bite, and it's across the spectrum, all the way from pet food guys like Chewy, or you know the bigger guys like an eBay and Amazon, all the way down to you know the furniture segment like Wayfair. We're seeing deceleration across e-commerce, so it's a tricky time. But there are a lot of interesting opportunities. On both sides of the book.
Right. When you think about key longs, is the list markedly shorter than the key shorts?
You know, our long book is perhaps the smallest that it's been in a long time. But, you know, as you were discussing with the previous guest, there are some really interesting opportunities out there in the software space in particular. You know, one of our biggest positions is a company called Smartsheet. They're a collaborative work management software provider, leader in the enterprise space with brand name customers like Cisco, Dell, Pfizer. They've got a net revenue retention rate in excess of 30%, which means that they're just from their existing customers are growing their spending 30%. And then they're adding new customers on top of that. So, you know, for a stock that's down 50% year to date, Carl, you've got they're growing billings at over 40%. They've got gross margins in excess of 80%. And with almost 500 million of cash on the balance sheet and free cash flow break even, they control their destiny. The stock's trading at 4x revenues. We think it's an amazing standalone, but you right. know, to the point on M&A you guys were referring to earlier, this could easily be acquired by any number of companies, including a Microsoft, ServiceNow, Workday, Cisco, to name a few.
I think what Glenn said, he said it's shopping season for software companies. Eduardo, you just brought up the idea of fintech competition. I think what you're saying is that space ripe for consolidation? If so, who do you think is doing the acquiring? Is it going to be the big banks who might be able to do so easier from a regulatory standpoint? Or say a big tech company like Apple or Alphabet that, you know, already have this presence but haven't gone into it in a huge way?
Well, I think fintech is still going to need some time. You're really just starting to see delinquencies starting to rise. And, you know, there's not what I would call blood in the streets as of yet. You did see Square, which is now called Block, acquired Afterpay last year in what was a very large deal. PayPal has also been fairly acquisitive. So I think it's likely that there'll be some consolidation, but I think it may be too soon for that.
Eduardo, yeah, want to go back to VMware and, you know, multiple perhaps points of interest there and this sort of multi-cloud environment that we're in, because I'm also noticing Nutanix shares are up about 6%, perhaps in reaction to some suggestions that Bain Capital could be looking at it. Really specifically on software and software that helps manage the cloud experience for big companies that are increasingly going to need it, whether we're in a recession or not. Is that where we should expect to see either go privates, M&A rumors? How should investors think about how to sift through those companies and find value?
Well, if you look, John, you've got some very large private equity firms that have just raised very significant funds, companies like Thoma Bravo, Vista Equity, to name a few, that have been very active in acquiring businesses. And I think that that trend is only going to accelerate with valuations where they are. I mean, most stocks in this sector are down 40, 50% year to date. And so for us, where we've been focusing our time and attention is on the companies that are continuing to grow in spite of the potential for a slowdown in the economy. You know, the other name that's a big name for us in the portfolio is a company called Five9. They're the largest player in the cloud center software space. And, you know, this is a space that there's 16 to 20 million call center seats globally, 80% of which are still on legacy Cisco and Avaya systems. And Five9, among the competitors, is rapidly taking share. You know, they just signed a $40 million deal with a large healthcare provider they announced last quarter. And so they're rapidly taking share. You saw that they were almost acquired by Zoom last year, but that deal was voted down by shareholders. And I think that this space in particular, the call center software space, is ripe for consolidation.
Well, we're going to get Zoom tonight. Maybe some color on what path they choose in the road ahead. But fascinating list. And we're clearly going to talk again soon, Eduardo. Thanks so much. Good to see you.
Thanks for your time, guys.
Eduardo Costa.
And after the break, Tech Check is live from Davos. Do not miss an exclusive with Palo Alto's chairman and CEO Nikesh Arora. That's up next. And we do have a big show ahead. We're just getting started here.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
John mentioned Nutanix. Let's get a gut check on that name. It's another stock that's jumping this morning on M&A speculation. A new report out saying that a possible takeover of the company by Bain Capital could be ahead. And with Nutanix 50% off of its highs, it is just the latest example of tech weakness turning into deal opportunity. Looking at that a lot these days, Carl.
Indeed, Dee. Meanwhile, let's get back to Sarah Eisen live at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, sitting down with the CEO of Palo Alto. Stock was up 10% Friday on those results. Hey, Sarah.
Very strong earnings. Hi, Carl. Good to see you again. And thank you, Nikesh Arora, CEO of Palo Alto, which is the world's biggest cybersecurity firm, for talking to us, a Davos regular. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
So a lot of talk about the geopolitical risks out there. You have an interesting... Whoa, very windy.
All right.
You have an interesting vantage point when it comes to cyber, and I'm curious what your level of concern is right now about some of the activity that you're seeing in front of you.
Well, Sarah, as you know, that over the last 2 or 3 years, we've been going through this phase where we are seeing cyber attacks, more supply chain attacks for the most part, where bad actors are hacking supply chain software and software we all use in our companies. And that's kind of become the way they're able to address tens of thousands of companies. And I think that's not going to stop. I think that's still going to go on. I have a feeling that some of the hacks we saw recently were more of a dry run of nation states testing their capabilities. I think there's more to come.
What about Russia specifically? There was concern as this war happened in Ukraine that we would see more. It feels like it's been sort of quiet from Russia. Is that just because we're not hearing about it? What's happening?
Well, I mean, if you look at the recent activity we've seen from the U.S. government, we are hearing from them that they want us to make our defenses more robust because they want us to get zero trust in place. They want critical infrastructure to make sure that, or financial services to make sure that their stuff is strong. So I think there is a sense of foreboding. I think, my personal opinion, the Russians have not turned their cyber guns yet on the West. But I think it depends on where and how this unfortunate war comes to a conclusion. But I can't imagine the Russian economy is going to be in a good place at that point in time. The question is, what do they have at their behest to try and create chaos in the rest of the West?
Are we, the U.S., prepared? Is our infrastructure, our companies prepared?
Look, there's always more that you can do. I think some parts of the infrastructure are more prepared than the others. But again, you know, every company is a tech company. And we saw the Colonial Pipeline hack. It's not a tech company, but somehow the hack was able to shut down the flow of oil. So you know, every company has to be prepared. Not everyone is, and it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we all are.
So this is why your earnings are so strong, because but even in a sort of more uncertain economic environment, you expect the spending on cloud security to continue.
Look, I think the uncertain economic environment was also there at the beginning of the pandemic. Oil prices were next to zero. You know, people were scared. Revenues went away. Stores shut down. So we had a whole bunch of customers who had no revenue. So they were re-looking at their costs. But nobody stopped spending money on cybersecurity. Nobody stopped spending money on technology. We're like the first cousins of technology. If you're going to spend more money on technology, you have to spend more money on security. And given where we are in the global landscape in terms of readiness of security, we see a disproportionate share being expended towards security.
What inning are we in the spending?
In the security spend or the IT spend?
Security.
I think we're very early. I think, pick your sport, we're in the third over of cricket. We're in the first innings of baseball.
Okay, that one I know.
Okay, yeah. Good.
but what about IT spending? Because there's a big question mark now with Europe potentially looking at recession and the U.S. economy slowing down.
I think, I've said this before, we're in the golden era of technology. I think every company is going to spend more money in technology because we're all becoming technology companies. You want to solve a problem where you'd have resources for labor, you automate. You want people to deliver food to your house, you automate. You want to buy groceries, you automate. So every company wants to become a tech company. Every store wants to become AR and VR enabled. Everybody wants to be in the metaverse. So I think we're going to see a lot more technology spend going forward. So in the short term, I'm not worried about the economic conditions. I think as the next 3 to 6 months transpire and we start seeing real impact to companies' P&Ls, we will see some marginal compression in technology spend, but overall, I'm not.
It's weighed on your stock, at least into earnings.
Well, it's weighed on every tech stock, and I think there's been a bit of a re-rating in the market, and that's always healthy because some things had run away too far. But look, our job is to keep our head down, keep generating cash flow for our shareholders, and the market will take care of itself.
You've got a lot of competition now. There's Zscaler and CrowdStrike, and can you all win amid this sort of rising wave of security spending?
Well, there's the total security market is about $140 billion a year, give or take. And, for us, we were 2.5% of the market 3 years ago when I started. Now we're getting close to 4 or 5%. So there's room to go. There's no large cybersecurity company which has a reasonable share in the market. We spent a lot of time and effort building capabilities, multiple categories, and those categories are helping us out in terms of allowing us to grow. Having said that, look, this is a big market. It's growing fast. There is room for more than one player.
What about VMware? I know it's not exactly a competitor, but they have cloud security business, and there's word today, a report today, that they're in talks to get bought by Broadcom.
Well, they have a small security business. I think they bought Carbon Black a while ago, which does endpoint security. So, yes, they are in the security business. Look, I personally don't understand the conglomerate strategy in the technology business, because in our business security, there is a buyer, and they are responsible for buying a certain set of things. If I buy more things that fit that portfolio, it works. If I buy adjacent things, I'm not sure how that works with the buyer, but I'm sure there are wiser minds behind that strategy.
Is that a dig at like a Microsoft or?
Not at all. Not at all. No, it's not a dig. It's just you have to have things that one buyer wants. If you split your portfolio amongst multiple buyers in the company, you become some sort of a technology conglomerate. Maybe there are specialist companies that are better. Ready to do that?
You do have something to say about that. I thought you were gonna dodge that question. Nikesh Arora,
I almost did.
you said something. Thank you for bearing with it. No snow, no ice, but a lot of wind.
That's
here
right.
In Davos,
that's right.
Switzerland. Thank you, CEO of Palo Alto. Back to you, John Fort.
Yeah, he almost dodged it, but you beamed him with it. Sarah, thank you, and Nikesh, thank you as well. Apple shares, meanwhile, on pace for their worst month since 2020, but our next guest is still bullish. Find out why after the break. Stay with us.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Ford, Deirdre Bosa, and Julia Boorstin. Checking in here half past the hour. A Dow, about a 2% gain, up 639 as energy and financials help out. But the NASDAQ is underperforming the other indices this morning. Top laggards are some software names like Zscaler, Okta, and Datadog. Let's get a news update this morning with our own Frank Holland. Hey, Frank.
Hey there, Carl. Here's what's happening at this hour. After 15 years in Russia, Starbucks is leaving that country in the wake of Putin's invasion of Ukraine. The coffee company is closing all 130 of its licensed locations. Russian workers will be paid for 6 months and then get help looking for new jobs. Pfizer says today that 3 small doses of its COVID vaccine provide strong protection to children younger than 5. The FDA says today its advisors will meet in mid-June to consider Pfizer's data. They may also look at Moderna's plan to vaccinate very young children. And Conan O'Brien has a brand new friend, SiriusXM. The company signed a 5-year deal for him to continue hosting his podcast, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, on SiriusXM, and is buying Team Coco, his digital media company. The Wall Street Journal values that deal at around $150 million in a news release. O'Brien says when he started in television, his ultimate goal was to work his way up to radio. That's the very latest. Carl, back over to you.
That sounds like something Conan would say, Frank. Thank you. More M&A could be coming in gaming. We have EA this morning at some multi-month highs, potentially seeking out a buyer, as our Julia Boorstin explains. Hey, Julia.
Well, Carl, with Take-Two Interactive's acquisition of Zynga closing today and Microsoft's acquisition of Activision Blizzard pending, the M&A attention shifts to the biggest independent video game player left, Electronic Arts. A report by Puck News out on Friday that Electronic Arts held deal talks with Comcast, CNBC's parent company, along with Disney, Apple, and Amazon, sending that stock up about 2%. Since Friday morning. Now, we've gotten a no comment from all of those companies, but sources close to the situation tell me that EA did indeed have preliminary talks with all 4 of those companies and that nothing advanced and nothing is imminent. One source tells me that EA approached Disney, but that the conversations did not advance. Another source saying that Comcast ended the conversation because they couldn't see a path forward on any key terms for a deal, such as price tag, structure, or management team. My sources tell me that nothing is imminent, but those talks do speak to growing focus on the value in video games, and EA is certainly the most valuable. It's the largest independent player left. Now, the video game sector, and EA in particular, have the advantage of a young, engaged demographic. EA says it has more than 500 million players around the world. It also has a strong library of games focused on sports with the Madden and NBA franchises. Those would, of course, be particularly valuable to the media and tech companies that own some of those sports rights. Plus, they have a large catalog of other titles. EA has hit Apex Legends. And then there's growing interest in esports, competitive video game playing. Now, EA tells us that it does not comment on rumors and speculation, and that they are proud to be operating from a position of strength and growth with a portfolio of amazing games. But guys, you just have to wonder which of these giants would be most interested in those EA assets.
Julia, give me your take, your analysis here, though, looking forward in the business models. Is this mostly about content library, the fact that EA has this high engagement in its, you know, games of reputation, or is this partly about putting together gaming capability, the content capability, with some organization that owns IP. You think about NBC Universal, you think about Disney. They've got plenty of IP. Often if you're a gaming company, you're trying to get access to that to provide momentum to your game. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you could put the two things together?
Well, look, I think IP is a key part of it. And you're right, John, it works both ways. Think about the different titles at the media giants that could translate into games or the video games that could be turned into movies. But I also think that it's more than that. I think it's about the direct relationship between the media and tech companies and consumers, and the fact that we're seeing the shift to streaming and the fact that they really want to own that one-to-one relationship with consumers, whether it's Comcast with Peacock or Disney with Disney Plus. You know, you have Amazon with that Prime Video relationship or Apple TV Plus. And the idea that games could be a key part of that. The people who play video games are incredibly engaged. And you have to wonder also with the likes of a Comcast. I mean, obviously, video games use a lot of, if you're streaming a game, if you're doing esports, that's all about broadband. You want high quality broadband. So that could be appealing there as well. And then with the fact that esports is this incredibly popular new kind of activity, people are going to esports conventions and are watching esports competitions, that's the kind of thing, hey, maybe that would work at a theme park venue, such as those owned by Disney or by Comcast. So there are all sorts of different things in play here, but I think it's really about that direct-to-consumer relationship. I mean, remember that Netflix is now making games itself, Dee.
That's right. But I wonder, Julia, did the move itself surprise you? I mean, I feel like they were just talking. EA CEO was just talking about them being more acquisitive going out. And they've acquired, what, $5 billion worth in terms of studios? And to that IP point, right, what John was asking you about, this is coming as EA is going to be losing some of those exclusive licenses like Star Wars, right? And then we were just talking about how it's rebranding FIFA because it's losing that license.
You're right. There has been a ton of consolidation in the space. I believe that EA has done four deals in the past 18 months, but I think this is about consolidation in general. The fact that Activision, Blizzard, Zynga, those deals are done, it's just a question of what comes next.
Julia, thank you. And take a look at shares of Apple. The stock is on pace for its worst month since 2020. Our next guest, though, is still bullish and just raised his iPhone estimates. Joining us now, Bank of America analyst Wamsi Mohan. Wamsi, I want to go to this M&A conversation first, because we've been talking about it all show, or at least the potential of it. Apple has, of course, a staggering amount of cash. Some might argue too much. It's never been particularly acquisitive in terms of the larger deals. Do you think that changes in this environment when valuations have come down so much? What would it take for Apple to look at, for example, an EA?
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Deirdre. Thanks for having me. I think it's been Apple's focus to make sure that they keep their innovation engine running, and they've been doing that largely from an internal perspective. I mean, they've done a phenomenal job of that. Now, that said, at some point, when you look at sort of what the benefit of the capital return is versus M&A, you do have to weigh those two things. And on the last conference call, we asked the management team whether it made sense to look at more M&A assets, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, some of these tech valuations have come down significantly. So from that perspective, I think there are adjacencies where Apple can go and look for certain deals. So, you know, health and fitness area, for instance, there are a lot of assets over there that are interesting, and Apple clearly has a priority within health. I think from a gaming perspective, they have been very insular, focused very much on internal development that you know, sort of aligns with the App Store model so far. So I think there's lower probability on the gaming side. I think it has to be something that's larger, more synergistic. At the same time, it's easy enough to absorb so that they don't have a lot of integration trouble and the company culture matches. So there are a lot of different things here, but I think it's going to be more so in the health and fitness area.
Right, and Wamsi, so you said you've been asking, have you sensed that anything has changed in the tone, even around the edges from the team at Apple, that would make you think that they might be becoming more amenable to it, to M&A?
I think, Julia, I'm sorry, Deirdre, I was going to say that, look, I think that they very much are a very acquisitive company. It's just that they do a lot of stuff that's more small, that's more private in nature, and they've been doing that for a very long period of time. In fact, they've probably acquired 50, 60 companies in not that many years, right? So they will continue to do so. I think on the margin, I would say that I was a little surprised that with their answer. I thought that they were a little bit more willing, you know, when pressed on the issue, but remains to be seen.
Hey, Wamsi, hard to talk Apple today and not discuss this journal story about them expressing a private interest in diversifying the manufacturing base away from China. And we've been talking about this for years, but are we in a different chapter here? And what country could possibly absorb their demand?
Yeah, Carl, look, I mean, I think that we actually have written about this in the past, talking about something which we said, which we called GAMA, or Get America Manufacturing Again, from a few years ago. And really, the crux of this is for the Apple supply chain to move meaningfully outside of China, two things need to happen. One, they need to find an area where you can actually get labor force participation at the right rates, at the right capability, with the right understanding and the ability to actually do this, but also be able to flex that labor force up and down. And so Southeast Asia, they have had some of their suppliers move to areas like Vietnam, like Thailand, like Malaysia, like India. So there have been a lot of areas where they've already started to diversify their manufacturing on certain products. Now, when you think about iPhone itself, I mean, that's a much larger scale operation, much harder to dislocate from a labor standpoint into other areas. But what we think it would take to really move that production is automation. So what you have to do is do a lot more of system on chip type of integration, be able to do a lot more with robotics, and be able to do a lot of that assembly work shifted away from a manual to an automated line. And when that happens, and we think that'll take several years to happen, but if something like that were to happen, then we could see them diversifying a lot more out of China. I don't think it's something that's going to happen for the iPhone, at least in the near term. They are making some attempts, for instance, with some of their manufacturing EMS partners to move into India, for instance, for certain models. But on a whole scale basis, to be able to really diversify out is extremely difficult to do.
Wamsi, you mentioned that Apple does do quite a bit of M&A, but it's on the smaller side. And as we're starting to get more information coming out about a VR, AR, really more AR headset, what are the opportunities there, perhaps even among smaller cap public companies, which would be more in Apple's, you know, traditional range? What are the opportunities, either in terms of companies themselves, small gaming studios, or they don't tend to be public, or even component suppliers that would be key to Apple supporting and growing this sort of product?
Yeah, look, AR, VR, I think, is extremely key to some of the new product roadmap aspirations that Apple has, particularly on the AR side, as you said, John. Look, I think that from a vertical integration standpoint, right, like we've been very clear about where they can do vertical integration. It's really been much more so on the silicon side. And that is where I think they will continue to do more and more vertical integration, as they've shown with the likes of the M1 and what they've done, obviously, on the iPhone for a long time, and what they're going to continue to do on that side. I think on more of the software side, they're going to do much more in-house. This is going to be hard to integrate, like, various different software assets. On displays, for instance, I think that, again, they're going to stay in an outsource model. We have companies like Corning that you know, are doing a lot of innovation jointly with them, and they're part of, like, the investment that Apple makes on a you know, five-year basis in terms of some of the capital that they are giving to some of their partners to be able to innovate. So I think there is a lot of opportunity for Apple mm-hmm. to do a lot of this innovation in-house. I think semiconductors is where most of the focus is going to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, on the fringes, they can look at certain smaller assets, but I don't think that it's really going to be a lift and shift. I mean, Apple typically takes, you know, 10 years to develop a product like this, right? Like, I'm sure this has been in the works now for a very long period of time.
Yeah, like its chip project was as well. Wamsi, thanks for your insights today. Wamsi Mohan, Bank of America.
Thanks for having me.
Let's check in on a mega cap tech name. Another one, Amazon, a report that the company is looking to shed some 10 million square feet of warehouse space after its massive capital investment. We will continue to watch that story. Meanwhile, the Dow way up more than 2% right now, translating into nearly 700 points. Financials surging. JP Morgan, Goldman, Visa, Amex, all trading sharply high. We're back in two.
Dow's up almost 700. Tech is coming off another week in the red, though. The longest losing streak for the Nas in about 20 years, although we're now trying to bounce hard today. Our senior markets commentator, Mike Santoli, is here with a look at how stocks are digesting some more signals of consumer weakness.
Yeah, Carl, and it's all how you slice it, the sectors. We were talking about this earlier. Take a look at Tesla and Amazon over the last 6 months. They are both consumer discretionary stocks. In fact, together, they make up almost 40% of the regular market cap weighted consumer discretionary sector. And you see they've almost had the same move, down 40% over the last 6 months. Now, this is the equal weighted version of the consumer discretionary sector. So it smooths out that overweight. And here you see, you know, it's about 10 percentage points better, almost 12 percentage points better. So the overall one is right in the middle there. So you have to know what you're getting when you're talking about the signals. Now, today, in general, it's non-tech that's working. It's banks, for the most part, that are the impetus for the upside here, Carl. But you have to see exactly what signals you're drawing from the different sector moves.
All right. Mike Santoli, thank you. Coming up, how crypto exchange FTX is shifting away from crypto. We'll have that in just a moment. Don't go away.
Gut check on Didi. Its life as a public company, nothing short of disastrous, comes to an end soon. Days after the company went public on the New York Stock Exchange in 2021, that was in June, Beijing launched a cybersecurity review, kicking Didi's apps off app stores in China. Revenue plunged, losses widened. That has all contributed to shares falling nearly 90% over that time, or $60 billion wiped out in market cap. Now the company hopes to get its services back onto Chinese app stores. Not clear, however, that a delisting will be enough for regulators. What it will do, though, is move Didi to the OTC market, the over-the-counter trading, where it will no longer need to file financial reports with the SEC. From $14 IPO price to about $1.50 today, it has been a wild ride for this company. More tech check after this. Stay with us. The M&A news continues. Crypto platform FTX is apparently shopping around for an acquisition target that would help it expand into stock trading. Our Kate Rooney broke that news first, and she joins us now with details. Kate, what are they looking at?
Hey, Dee. Yeah, that's right. Crypto exchange FTX has been quietly shopping for stock trading startups and looking at potential deals. I'm told by sources the crypto firm has approached at least three privately held brokerage companies about an acquisition. The list includes Webull, Apex Clearing, and Public.com. This is according to sources familiar with those talks who asked not to be named because the discussions were confidential. These talks were very early stages. No term sheets were signed, I'm told, and no comment from those companies or FTX on this. But it does speak to FTX's ambitions in the space and a broader effort by the whole industry to really bring stocks and crypto trading under one roof. Just last week, FTX announced its official move to offer stocks. It's already made a couple investments in the space. In April, it took a stake in IEX, that's a stock exchange operator, and notably Robinhood. That one was through FTX CEO Sam Bankman-Fried. The 7.6% stake was disclosed in an SEC filing. That's fueled a lot of questions about potential deals in this space and about Robinhood's future as an M&A target, as well as its share price drops more than 80% from that high last summer. That SEC filing I mentioned, Bankman-Fried says no plans to push changes at Robinhood, and he sees it as what he calls an attractive investment. Bottom line, though, I'm told, expect a lot more M&A and consolidation in this space as prices come down. Carl.
Yeah, that space is evolving quickly. Kate, thank you. Kate Rooney. Meantime, inflation pain. Tune in tonight for another CNBC special on the state of the consumer. Inflation and your stocks kicks off tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern time. One thing that has not been inflated, the price of Twitter shares down again today. Elon Musk still has a signed legal agreement to buy at $54.20. Investors not as confident that deal will go through, although this is still a dollar above last week's low. Back in a moment.
Welcome back. One more thing before we go. This weekend, I had the great honor of delivering the commencement address to the graduating class of 2022 at my alma mater, DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. The year was 1998. Google was founded. Apple unveiled the iMac. And a few months before those two things happened, I graduated from DePauw. Yesterday, I shared a little of what I learned on those campus grounds and after, lessons of love, truth, and impact. I have a weekly segment I created on CNBC called On the Other Hand, and I argue one side of a contentious business issue for a minute, and then I say, on the other hand, and argue the complete opposite just as passionately. What I enjoy most about On the Other Hand is what it teaches me as I'm researching and writing it.
Every week I start out pretty sure I know what I think about a given issue, and every week by the time I'm finished writing, I'm less sure. Sometimes I've changed my mind completely because I'm trying to have an honest debate with myself in search of truth.
people often ask what I really believe in these On the Other Hand segments. Sometimes I really don't know. I just made the argument.
Because they're so good, John. You argue both, like you said, so passionately. I change my mind watching them as well, right when I think you've convinced me. I've gone the other way, Carl. I'm sure sometimes you felt the same.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that Billy Joel lyric, John. Shades of Grey are all that I know. The more I find out, the less that I know, which is certainly what that segment has taught all of us. Congratulations on that. That's fantastic. You've been listening to The Opening Bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.